I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the songs and the story of Roy Orbison. His friends and contemporaries were Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, The Beatles, and so many more. The unlikely rock and roll icon from a small town in West Texas. He didn't have the look or the swagger of a rock and roll rebel, but he cut his own path to the top of the charts with songs like Pretty Woman, Only the Lonely, Running Scared, It's Over, In Dreams, Crying. On this pre-recorded Source, we'll listen to those hits and trace Roy Orbison's path from hits to heartache and his phenomenal comeback. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news. I couldn't help but see Pretty Woman.
The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/edd/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
I'm David Martin Davies, and this is The Source. With me is Jeff Slate, co-author of The Authorized Roy Orbison, written alongside the three surviving sons, Roy Jr., Wesley, and Alex Orbison. While an accomplished songwriter and guitarist, Roy Orbison is best known for his voice. The pitch and range made him one of the greatest vocalists in the history of American rock and roll. Slate said Orbison's golden pipes came from both nature and nurture.
I think it came from sort of a combination of both his mom and dad. The way I understand it, they both had very sweet singing voices that had sort of an operatic nature to them. I mean, we don't really know, but that's sort of the story. And I think as he developed that in front of a live band, it became this other thing. You know, it wasn't like sitting around the family house, jawboning and kind of, you know, playing songs for each other the way his family and their, you know, extended family did. It became standing in front of a band with a bunch of amplifiers, with a PA. And, you know, it developed over time. I think, too, it was something that he had, certainly during his son years, but didn't get developed or recognized. I mean, I think everybody knew he had this great voice, but at a time when Elvis and maybe, you know, outside son Little Richard were the benchmark, Roy seemed to be just another guy. It wasn't until he got to Monument and Fred Foster, who was the producer for him there, who recognized, oh, this guy's got something else going on, and started to encourage him and help him to get a little less self-conscious about his voice. Because I think, especially in those early days, Roy didn't really rank his voice very highly. He just, you know, it was just sort of another tool in his toolbox. He could play the guitar, he could write, he could sing. It was just kind of another thing he did. It wasn't until he'd gotten some recognition for it in the mid-60s with Crying and In Dreams and some of these other songs, and certainly Running Scared, that he started to realize that it was something special and unique. And it was funny because much later in life, I interviewed and talked to both Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty about it. And, you know, Tom Petty told me this great story about he was in the studio and Roy was like, they were sitting on a couch and Roy was practicing his parts because the way George Harrison made the Wilburys records, he would sort of have them all sing the entire song. And then he would, whoever did the best job, you know, you got to perform for George Harrison. Whoever did the best job, delivered the best performance, kind of got the main piece. And then he built the song, the track around that. And so Roy was sitting on the couch practicing in kind of a quiet voice. And Tom said, you know, this was just at low volume, just kind of practicing for himself. And he said, it was the most beautiful, amazing thing. And he said, one time he said to Roy, boy, Roy, you've really got the greatest voice in rock and roll. And Roy just said, Yeah. You know, I mean, by that time, you know, near the end of his life, he knew it. So I think it was an evolution more than anything else.
So you mentioned Running Scared, and that is this song that builds up to that high natural A at the very end. And he tells the story how that came about. And I think that's the breakthrough for him on his voice.
I think it was a breakthrough in many respects. I think Running Scared pushed the envelope in several ways. First of all, he never worried about songwriting convention. So when he sat down to write this, he didn't worry about verse, chorus, bridge, you know, verse, chorus. He just wrote where the story took him. And that became this sort of epic build. When he went into the studio and he and Fred Foster kind of outlined the arrangement, they weren't afraid to pull in basically an orchestra, which is fairly unheard of for rock and roll music at that time. It was, you know, used in pop music, but not for the rank and file rock and rollers.
In 1961.
Fred Foster wasn't afraid to do that. The other thing was he really coached and encouraged Roy to go for it. And I think those three things combined, but I don't think they did more than a couple of takes of that. And they were live takes. He's on the floor with the band, with the performers, with the musicians, singing. Not like people do it now and they overdub it and they tweak it and they auto-tune it.
Right.
I mean, this was a performance.
It's called recording in concert. They basically have to do the whole thing at once. There's no splicing. It's from the beginning to the end. And from what I understand from a story that he told is that they did three takes. The first take,
yeah,
where he blew the end. He didn't come out strong enough.
Right.
And the engineer told him, Roy, you really got to bring it. You kids can't, you know, wimp around on this. And he felt embarrassed. And so,
right,
and then they said, okay, we'll start again. And he said, if you don't get it right this time, we're gonna lose this song. And I would have
right.
And then he came out again, and he hit that high A at the end, and it was so good that all the musicians stopped playing. They were amazed.
Right.
And then they came back, and they did it again, and it's this. Let's play it right now.
Just running scared. Each place we go, so afraid that he might show.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're taking a quick break. Here's another Rockabilly Roy Orbison cut, also at Sun Records, 1956, with his band, the Teen Kings. It's Go, Go, Go.
Well, you can't be my lord, baby. You ain't got the style.
I'm gonna get some real gone love that'll drive a cool cat wild. Gonna move, roll that right on down. Gonna get me a gal that'll go out on the town.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is Roy Orbison's Only the Lonely, 1960, his first record after leaving Sun. And we start to see a new Roy Orbison using his voice more as an instrument and through the work of Nashville sound engineer Bill Porter.
Only the lonely know the way I feel tonight. Only the lonely know this feeling ain't right. There goes my baby, there goes my heart, they're gone forever. So far apart, but only the lonely know why I cry. Only the lonely
know why. Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, 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 oh. Only the lonely.
The man in the dark sunglasses from Wink, Texas, is remembered for his haunting, beautiful voice and emotive songwriting. Many of Orbison's songs were hits during his long career, particularly in the early 1960s. In the United States, he secured two number one hits on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, Running Scared in 61 and Oh Pretty Woman in 64. Only the Lonely reached number two in 1960, and Crying peaked at number two in 1961. But Orbison's impact on rock is greater than his record sales, which was expressed by Bruce Springsteen when in 1987 he inducted Orbison into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I'd lay in bed at night with just the lights on my stereo on, and I'd let Crying and Love Hurts and Running Scared and Only the Lonely and It's Over fill up my room. Well, some rock and roll reinforces friendship and community, but for me, Roy's ballads were always best when you were alone and in the dark.
Roy constantly defied convention. He constantly wanted to push the envelope to try to find new sounds, new techniques, whether it was songwriting, guitar playing, singing.
Jeff Slate is the co-author of The Authorized Roy Orbison. He's a songwriter and music journalist.
You know, this was a time, you have to remember, when the pop charts were pretty saccharine. And his contemporaries, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis, Johnny Cash, you know, they weren't having much success on the charts. It had really been, you know, it was how much is that doggy in the window and things like that. So Roy was not afraid to do something bold and dramatic. And certainly Running Scared can be described as bold and dramatic. But I think, too, you know, ultimately he had to deliver the goods. And I think you're right. This is one of those instances where everything came together for him. It was a great song. It was a great performance. The arrangement was great. He had a great team working with him in, you know, in the control booth. And that really catapulted him in his monument years to sort of the next stage of his career.
So you mentioned Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash. These are all people who came through Sun Records, as did Roy Orbison. But his time at Sun Records, he had problems. They forced him to record things like Chicken Hearted, and they didn't want him to be a ballad singer.
I'd like to be a hero, but I ain't got the nerve. I'm chicken hearted. I'm chicken hearted.
Later in life, Sam Phillips, you know, boohooed a bit about the fact that he lost Roy, that he didn't really appreciate Roy during his years at Sun. But I think it was also, you know, Roy was, you know, he was a regional artist who hadn't reached his potential yet. And maybe Sam Phillips wasn't the right producer for him. The great thing for Roy is, for the rest of his life, he was a Sun Records artist. I mean, he carried that with him forever. And that's pretty serious stuff when you're, you know, any fan of rock and roll knows the Sun Records brand. But I think, you know, he was young, he was inexperienced, he just started writing songs. He didn't have all that much under his belt. The Teen Kings, who were a great band for him as a regional act in Texas and the surrounding area, maybe weren't, you know, primetime ready, so to speak. That's not to say, you know, not to put them down, but, you know, when Elvis made the leap, you know, he had great people working with him, and Johnny Cash had great people working with him. So I think it was several things, but I think most of all he was young and green. And so the songs that he wrote, except for Ooby Dooby and a couple of others, which he wrote long before he came to the attention of Sam Phillips, were okay. They weren't Running Scare. They weren't Oh Pretty Woman. They, you know, they weren't Crying or In Dreams. And so I think that it took a little, you know, it took a little time on the road and some time really pushing himself, both on the guitar but as a songwriter. And he had to find Joe Melson, too, who he ended up having a long and fruitful partnership as a songwriting duo. So it wasn't just Sam Phillips's fault. It wasn't just Roy's. Like many things in Roy's life, it was this hand of fate that kind of, he was lucky to have that Sun Records moniker next to his name, and yet he really needed to take the next step somewhere else.
Sun Records, but I want to play another cut from the Sun Record days, and this is a song that many people covered. This is Trying to Get to You.
Well, I've been driving over mountains, now even through the valleys too. Well, I've been driving my days, running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Well, since I read your loving letter,
even before Roy Orbison got to Sun Records, he was in Wink, Texas. And, of course, everyone knows that Wink, Texas is right there next to Kermit, Texas. And but for those,
everybody knows that.
Yeah. It's near Marfa, you know, not that far from Marfa, kind of between and Midland, Odessa.
Yep.
And so that was a place of desolation, but also of a lot of cultural interchange. I've heard that Roy said that some of the big influences are rockabilly, swing, and mariachi.
Pistolero, pistolero, where do you ride? Pistolero, pistolero,
You ride alone tonight. One of brothers five one day vowed to try to make his way. Joined a cattle drive to Mexico. Threw in with some banditos. Yeah, he learned their lingo. Killed a man, they call him Pistolero. 5,000 pesos they put on your head. 5,000 pesos to get you alive or dead. Ride on, ride hard, young vaquero. Fast as you can to her side. Ah, but por mucho dinero. El noveno.
I think the interesting thing is, you know, like sort of the Beatles and all the artists in England who could hear Radio Luxembourg, you know, and got a lot of their radio, not from the BBC, but from this, you know, almost pirate radio station from another country, Roy could hear these DJs from all, you know, you got Texas, it's flat. Radio waves carry pretty far in that area.
You got the border blasters.
Exactly. And I think the amazing thing is, you know, there is no border when it comes to music. There's no boundaries when it comes to music. So if you hear something and you like it and it makes your toe tap, as Roy once said, you try to incorporate it. And he was never afraid to do that. So if he heard music that was from Mexico or wherever, you know, whether it was rockabilly from another part of the country or wherever it was, or it was Buddy Holly from Lubbock. I mean, this was music that was inspiring him, and it was in the stew of his references that he would draw upon pretty much throughout his entire career, not just in those early days when he was young and trying to find his own sound.
So you mentioned Buddy Holly. Now, Buddy Holly and Roy were contemporaries. They were the two big dogs in West Texas that were performing at shows. And Roy said that he considered Buddy Holly to be like a little brother of his, and he really took his death very hard.
You know, Roy loved the people who were like him. In other words, Elvis and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash and, like you said, Buddy Holly. He felt a kinship with them. Because I think he felt when they were hanging out, whether it was backstage or, you know, Elvis came to his house and had dinner on the fly, you know, a few times, I think he felt a kinship with them because only they were experiencing what he was experiencing. And only they felt the pressures, having family at home, bills to pay, but these producers and record labels kind of hounding you to deliver, deliver, deliver all the time. New, and, you know, get up there on the stage and make some money. And, you know, there were very few people who could identify with that when it was so new. Rock and roll was brand new. And touring in that manner and making records in that kind of guerrilla fashion that they were was very different than anything that had happened previously in the century. So I think that Roy looked at people like Elvis or certainly Buddy Holly as kindred spirits.
Two wheels are turning, one girl a yearning, big motor burning the road. I'll ride the highway, I'm going my way, I leave a story untold. Pretty girls behind.
Going to break with an Orbison single from 1965. Right Away wasn't a hit. It reached 25 on the Hot 100, but there is so much in this song. Released during a transitional period in Orbison's career, Right Away reflects his ability to adapt to changing musical trends while staying true to his distinctive style. And the song is a classic example of Orbison's storytelling. It holds up 60 years later.
Right away,
with your kisses. Won't you come to my arms, sweet darling, and stay? Always lay with your kisses. Why, oh, why do you want to do me this way? How long do you think I can wait? When you know you're always late, always late with your kisses. Why, oh, why do you want to do me this way?
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and yep, that's not Roy Orbison, that's Lefty Frizzell. Roy would list him as one of his major influences for his singing style, his use of range and phrasing. Roy Orbison had so much affection for fellow Texan Lefty Frizzell that on the Traveling Wilburys, his first album, Roy was ID'd as Lefty Wilbury. Here's the co-author of the authorized Roy Orbison biography, Jeff Slate.
Any great artist like Bob Dylan or the Beatles or Bruce Springsteen or anybody who is the sum of their influences. Roy is a good example of that. It's just his influences were before many of us have the cultural reference. So while a lot of people don't know Lefty Frizzell, if they go back and listen, they'll hear a lot of Roy Orbison. They'll understand where Roy came from. It's like people who become, you know, fans of the Beatles, they go back and listen to the records that the Beatles were playing or learning when they were kids or playing in Hamburg or the Cavern, and they hear, you know, you listen to Buddy Holly or the Everly Brothers or, you know, anything that came before them, and you then understand that's the stew that made the Beatles. It's just the same with Roy. It's just that the records he loved were made in the 30s and 40s.
Well, Roy and the Beatles, they got to hang out together quite a bit because when Roy toured in England, they opened up for him. There was some kinship there.
Yeah, I think it's a relationship that was forged in kind of the mania that both Roy and the Beatles were experiencing at that time. I mean, Roy was hugely famous in the UK when he toured there with the Beatles, and the Beatles were on the cusp of Beatlemania and superstardom there. So I think, you know, people were screaming for the Beatles. They were screaming for Roy. Again, it was that kind of no one else was experiencing what they were experiencing, and he got to be really tight. You know, everybody knows that he developed a close friendship and relationship with George Harrison that carried through the years. But that was true of Ringo and Paul McCartney as well. When Paul McCartney was in Nashville in 1974 cutting some basically country tracks and taking a vacation with Wings, he hung out with Roy. I mean, you know, he wasn't far from Hendersonville, and they visited, and Roy came to McCartney's rented house for dinner, and McCartney and Linda went to Roy's house and visited. So, it was one of these things that, you know, when you're Roy Orbison, we forget this, but when you're Roy Orbison, it's hard to just have to maybe make new friends, I guess. You know, you're a huge mega star on the world stage. So to find people like the Beatles who had, you know, similar values, they were trying to create something new. They were trying to push the boundaries of songwriting. They were trying to create new ways of recording and producing records. I mean, I think he really saw in them kindred spirits, and he really loved them. And they, by all accounts, every one of them loved Roy. I mean, you know, the famous story John Lennon wrote, "Please Please Me," as an homage to Roy Orbison, and then they kind of, George Martin sped it up and made it a number one hit. But originally, it was kind of a slow, ethereal ballad, and that was really a tribute to how much he loved Roy.
Here's Paul McCartney and then John Lennon talking about the Orbison influence on Please Please Me, their first number one hit.
We've got a song called Please Please Me. This is one John had just written, and it was kind of slow Roy Orbison kind of thing. Come on, jump, jump, come on, please, please me. Big note at the end, just like Orbison.
And I'd heard Roy Orbison doing Only the Lonely or something, and I was trying to please me. That's where that came from. And also, I was always intrigued by the words of "Please lend your little ears to my plea," Bing Crosby song. I was always intrigued by the double use of the word "please."
Roy's had his share of tragedy in his life. Can you talk about that and how we hear that in the music?
Well, Roy is certainly known as the dark, brooding archetype of the rock star. I mean, he kind of single-handedly invented the modern idea of a rock star, you know, clad in black, sunglasses, black hair.
And black was not his natural hair color. He was a blonde.
Yeah, he was. He had light hair, and the pictures of him in the book are just, you know, they kind of tickle me every time I look at him because he looks so different. But
So we have that crafted image of Roy Orbison, but there's also, I mean, the tragic that kind of, he's a man carrying a burden.
He carried a heavy load, and yet he never let it bring him down. I think that was significant. And in everything that I learned about Roy while we were writing this book, it was that he tried to approach everything with a sense of fate and destiny and try to see the other side. You know, instead of wallowing in self-pity when any of these tragedies befell him, he tried to see toward the future. And I think, you know, it was one of these funny things. He loved Monty Python, and he could recite those skits and sing their songs. And this was a guy who had lost so much in his life, you know, two sons and his wife Claudette, and, you know, innumerable friends over the years, and Elvis when they had rekindled their friendship. You know, all these things happened to him during his lifetime, not to mention he had career setbacks several times that would have crushed a lesser person. And yet he tried to just forge ahead, make a plan, try to be positive. There's a section in the book where Johnny Cash went to visit him, and he said Roy was as low as he'd ever seen any man in his life. He tried to speak to him as honestly as Johnny Cash said he would want anybody to speak to him. And I think that kind of camaraderie, because Johnny Cash had certainly seen tragedy in his life, you know, made Roy that switch kind of flip in him, and he was able to go, okay, I've got to get back on the horse, I've got to write some songs, I've got to get back on the stage, I've got a family to support, and he always tried to do that no matter what happened to him. So, yes, you're right. I mean, I think it's reflected in his music. There's certainly nobody better at singing the big, epic, sad ballad. But, you know, I think there's humor and pathos in his music that belies the tragedy and agony. And I think that's important to recognize, too.
So his first wife, Claudette, she died in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah.
And then not long afterwards, his two sons were killed in a fire while he was on tour. You can't help but think that sometimes when he's sings songs like in Dreams, that he's not thinking about them.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, "Go to sleep, everything is all right." I close my eyes. Drift away into
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is Roy Orbison's 1961 number one hit, Crying.
I was all right for a while. I could smile for a while. But I saw you last night. You held my hand so tight as you stopped to say hello. Oh, you wished me well. That I've been crying over you, crying over you. Said so long, left me standing all alone, alone and crying, crying, crying. Crying, it's hard to understand, but the touch of your hand can start me crying. I thought that I was over you, but it's true, so true.
That burden, it never left him. I think, though, because he was able, as everybody says, he was great to be around and really fun and had a great sense of humor. I think probably his music was his outlet for those emotions, because we don't really see it in his everyday life. He didn't wallow in self-pity. He put all that emotion into his performance, into his, you know, being live on stage and also in the recording studio, and just in writing those songs that really do touch everybody's hearts to this day. I think that's where the well he drew on, and that's where he channeled that agony.
Many people look back at Roy Orbison and they hear all the fantastic voice, musical ability, his stage persona, and they have this assumption, this inevitability of success for Roy Orbison. He hit some spots where his vehicle was repossessed and he was just struggling trying to hang on to be in the music industry. People don't understand how alpha this guy really was. He was determined, and I think that's also a big part of the Roy Orbison sound.
Tom Petty said this really well when we talked about Roy one time. You know, you have to be a little bit of a bastard to be a great rock and roller. You have to have some tragedy in your life. You have to be able to draw on that. You have to have that maybe driving you. But also you have to be a pretty tough cookie. And I think, you know, Tom certainly was. I think everybody knows that. But I think you're right. We don't know as much about Roy and how he got there. We kind of just accept that Pretty Woman, you know, is evergreen, will always be with us as a giant song. But I think there were so many setbacks in his life.
Pretty woman, walking down the street. Pretty woman, the kind I like to meet. Pretty woman, I don't believe you, you're not the truth. No one could look as good as you. Mercy.
But he had some rough and lean years. And so it wasn't then inevitable that Don McLean and Linda Ronstadt would record his songs, that a new generation of, you know, the sort of Laurel Canyon singer-songwriter would discover him and he'd be opening for the Eagles and then become a touring act, a viable touring act again on his in his own right.
Or that T-Bone Burnett would put together his concert, Black and White, you know, things like that.
The Black and White Night special, which was just kind of this apex for him late in his career. There was so much goodwill for Roy within the industry that he and Barbara had these friends who had a deal with Cinemax. They pitched this special as this kind of very cool retro shot in black and white evening with Roy. And it was T-Bone Burnett who got involved, and everybody he called, one after the other, said yes, and so it became Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Costello, Tom Waits, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, and the TCB band, and James Burton backing him up.
Traveling Wilburys, this first super group, you know, and that kind of came about by accident. People just sort of, hey, let's go over here. Let's go. Oh, Bob Dylan. Oh, yeah. Tom Petty's got my guitar. Let's go. And the next thing you know, you've got some of the greatest rock and rollers ever to putting together these songs. And Roy Orbison's there. And what did that mean for Roy Orbison?
Well, I think more than anything, like everything in his career, it was first built on friendship. I think he really loved those guys. And they loved and really admired and respected him. So they just had this great mutual admiration society. But I think, you know, having spoken to both Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty about the Wilburys, and also, you know, having done the research for the book and talked to his sons, you know, I think they just had fun.
Being beat up and battered around, being sent up and I've been shut down. You're the best thing that I've ever found. Handle me with care. Reputation's changeable. Situation's terrible. But baby, you're adorable. Handle me with care. I'm so tired of being lonely.
Internet and streaming and Spotify and Tidal and all these other services, the leveling effect it has been that great performances and great songs, not the look, not the salacious part, not the backstory, but great songs is what carries the day. And so all three of Roy's sons told me while we were putting this book together, when they travel the world, when they're in an airport and somebody realizes who they are, they make a public appearance and people come up to them and talk about their father's music, it's You Got It that people talk about. And certainly Pretty Woman and In Dreams and other, but they're talking about a song that wasn't Roy's biggest hit, and it's relatively recent. It's not maybe the song that you or I or some of the older people who are Roy's fans might think of as a signature hit. But it is no doubt an absolutely fantastic song. So a kid who's 15 years old, and that comes, that's on the soundtrack of Nerve, like it was last year, they just assess it as, sounds good to me. They don't think, this is Roy Orbison. They don't think, you know, anything beyond, it's a good song, and it's capturing my imagination in this moment. And so then they go home, they add it to their Spotify playlist, they, you know, dial it up on YouTube, whatever they do. That's how Roy and some of his contemporaries will live forever. It's because the songs were timeless and the performances were so great that they'll live, you know, long beyond the lifetime of the artist.
Jeff Slate is the author of The Authorized Roy Orbison. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This song was written by Bono and The Edge of U2 for Orbison, released in 1989, a year after his death. She's a mystery to me.
Darkness falls and she will take me by the hand, take me to some twilight land where all but love is gray, where I can't find my way without her as my guide. Night falls, I'm cast beneath her spell. Daylight comes, our heaven turns to hell. Am I left to burn and burn eternally? She's a mystery to me. She's a mystery girl. She's a mystery girl. In the night of love, words tangled in her hair, words soon to disappear. A love so sharp it cut like a switchblade to my heart, words tearing me.